Hey, this is Larry Nemechek, Dr. Trek, and you're listening to the Warm Blanket Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Warm Blanket Podcast, where we embark on the journey to see what makes us feel good about Star Trek, where our love comes from, and what it means for us. In short, where is our warm blanket? My name is Gary, I'm your host, and I'm very honored to welcome here my very first special guest today, the one and only Larry Nemechek, established author, actor, podcaster, consultant, and sci-fi tour guide, also known as Dr. Trek from the galaxy not so far away called Trekland. Let's give a warm welcome to the wonderful Mr. Larry Nemechek.
Wow, that was a great interview. The galaxy not so far away known as Trekland. I love that. Okay.
Nice. It's a very it's a big honor to have you on the show. As I mentioned off camera, I was a really always a big admirer of your work and what you do with Star Trek, and try to conserve what Star Trek is. And I think it's really, well, it's just an interesting way to start this podcast with a question that I had in mind. How did you become Dr. Trek?
Oh, well, the short answer is my marketing and business people said, you need something, you need a tagline, you know, thing. And because in the beginning it was like, oh my God, that was so cheesy, but now I get it now, because it's a lot easier to say, you know, on the second line in a Chiron in the lower third, to say Dr. Trek than it is to say all that stuff you just said, right? Mm-hmm. Author, publisher, you know, actor, bon vivant, man about town, whatever. Because when you list all those things out, it sounds like, wait a minute, isn't that like jack of all trades, master of none? That's
just
what
I was thinking,
right?
Yes.
Exactly. See, Dr. Trek, people might go, well, that's cheesy, but then they laugh and they go on. And the last thing they do is think, oh, master of none. Okay, yay. That's good. When I was first working in news, and I was at our local Oklahoma City area Star Trek Club, that I went back and joined again. I was in news and was getting the promotional mailings for Next Generation. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, and we had a newsletter. And that was in the days when the newsletter was you wrote whatever you wanted to write and made the copies. And then you came to the club meeting and then we all stapled them together. And that was our newsletter. Okay, so it's like dead paper days, right? Okay. So my thing that I always contributed after a while, well, I said, well, I'll write a Star Trek column. Okay. And then it was like, well, you know, I'll just do a Q&A column and I'll answer people's, which is silly because this is like, you know, 15 or 20, 25 people. Like they just, if they had a question, they would just ask me. No one's going to write down anyway. But that was the idea. And so instead of answering questions back in the day, I would share all the promo, because we'd get the information on the new episodes like a month or two in advance, but it was legit. It wasn't like leaks. It was the promo mailers, and you'd find them on eBay now. And so, I mean, you know, collect them. And I would just put the next four or five episodes up and the dates and the synopsis. Okay, so that's what it was. So anyway, so the name of that was called Ask Dr. Trek, because it was supposed to be a Q&A, but it was never no one ever asked a question. So it just turned into me putting out the promo information because I was getting through our newspaper. So that's where the term came from. So you fast forward, you know, 20 years, and I had some friends and they were like, so couldn't you just call yourself something? Just call yourself something short, you know, like Mayor of Trekville or something. And I went, oh, that's, yeah. And I said, well, I could do this Dr. Trek thing. And they're like, oh, that's great, that's great. And I was like, that's so creepy. Ooh, ooh. But it's one of those things where you got to get over yourself.
So you basically took on the name that you didn't want at the beginning.
there is no approved course of study. There is no sheepskin. But you know, not a single person has ever come up and go, you're not a real doctor, Trek. I mean, no one's actually like taking it seriously and then like written me off, which was the point. But I mean, it's a fun thing. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. But again, it does a lot of work. It as my coaches would say it does a lot of heavy lifting and gets the so. And now we have fun with it because on Life Support Live that I do with Dr. Ali Mattu, which is looking at Star Trek through a mental health lens, and we give tips for, you know, living. And I love it because it's something aspirational, not just trivia about, you know, how many pips are on an ensign junior grade or something. Now we have fun with that, and we say it's Dr. Trek and Dr. Ali, and one of us is a real doctor, you know.
So were you always interested about sci-fi?
Well, yes, but not like as a dump. That was part of my problem. I had, I was one of these kids that I had like a million interests. And I had a million, back when we called them hobbies, which is a nerdier word now that no one ever says. Now we have fandoms and we have passion. we have our geek flags, you know, and all that. But back in the day, no, it would have been like, oh my God, don't call me a nerd or a geek. That would have been like ostracizing. So no, I'm a hobbyist, which is very old school. Like to me, and if you say it now, even to me, if you say I'm a hobbyist, you're a stamp collector, you know, or you're a collector, or you're whatever. But no, I was, my overridingly, I always loved history since I, the second or third grade, I can remember being, when I discovered American history, and was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Don't ask me why, but and I was, I liked science. I had like a chemistry set, and you know, I liked doing experiments and all that kind of thing. But I liked history, and I was a very, and I had a lot of interests. And I built models, like model rocketry, model railroading, you name model, just model building, you know. And I was, all of that combined when I was a kid, I was also, it was also during the Apollo moonshots when I was little, and I was a big NASA kid and would get the photos from NASA PR. So somewhere, then it was like, and I've said this many times, my ninth grade science teacher was, when we had like the reruns after school, right? Because I was a rerun baby. And she was like her first year out of college teaching. And she was, long story short, she was aghast one day when she found out that I didn't get her Trek reference. And she was like, don't, she's like, oh, Larry, don't tell me you don't watch Star Trek. And I was like, well, no. It's that show with the guy with the ears. I literally, that was my, you know. So I went home and started watching after school. And yeah, within a few weeks. And the thing that got me was, I mean, I got sucked in because I enjoyed it. I didn't really have labels or conscious. I just, it was cool. I was, you know, like in junior high, and it was cool. And I think what started to crystallize it was when I got either the technical manual or the Making of Star Trek first. They were new. And I, my first reaction to this was, oh my God, they planned all this. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's like one of those, oh my gosh. And I didn't realize, you know, subliminally that the Making of Star Trek was telling you how TV was made. And that wasn't a common thing for somebody in Oklahoma in the middle, you know, halfway between LA and New York out in the, you know, nowhere. But yeah, that was, and I had like all these other interests and I do clubs and, you know, passion things and all that. But, and then I went to high school and was trying to figure out what to do with my life. And I was interested in I finally took some aptitude tests and I was interested in communications. So I always thought I would go into TV and radio, and I wound up going into print first. But at the same time, I was in theater. So, you know, it's like all of this communicatively. So yeah, that was, that's where Dr. Trek came from.
So it's interesting that you got, as you said, you got sucked into Star Trek, just the same way how you got actually into being Dr. Trek as well. So you didn't necessarily wanted to use Dr. Trek first, and you didn't necessarily know about Star Trek much, but then you got into it because of a referral. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
In a
sense. Part of
I'm not trying to twist it, but
no. This is why you know, different eyeballs are good on this. Different perspectives are good. No, the Dr. Trek was the world changing to where, I mean, I knew the world, like the whole digital revolution, the whole end of big box things, because I'd always I'm just little me, and yes, I wrote this book and I'm very proud of it by then. I'm just little me. I'm part, you know, I was editing Communicator Magazine, which was the official U.S. magazine of the U.S. fan club, licensed and official for 8 years. And I was doing some official things, especially after we moved to L.A., for 10 years, but it was always as part of something bigger. And it's I'm still part of something bigger. But the world of being a little wheel in a big, a little gear in a big machine, that's all blown up. A lot of blown up in 2005 and onward, thanks to digital revolution, the computer revolution, things being global, the internet.
Yeah.
And things that I was trained for in the world that I knew about, like in news and communication, that doesn't, nobody pays for copy editing. It's like, slop it out there and get it on the net fast, quick, you know, and I'll, here's your 5 cents. You know, it's like everything is, you know, if you wonder why so much is misspelled, it's because nobody, it's out in 5 minutes. There is no copy editing lot. Even with prestigious newspapers with a website, it's sad to read things. I mean, I'm on a tangent. But anyway, that world was just like shocking. It's like, how am I supposed to make a living? How am I supposed to feed a family if everything I used to work at and work in is blowing up? And nobody has a new, this was like the late aught. This is like when Star Trek blew up, when the Paramount, when the Viacom divorce happened, and when Decipher Games all but went bankrupt that owned the fan club. Anything would have gone down, we could have recovered. But between no new Star Trek being made, the Star Trek maker blowing up, which meant that everybody that I worked with in licensing and licensors and all of that was all gone, and there were only one or two people left standing. And the old StarTrek.com was left standing, but then that was taken out because its new owner didn't know the legacy of Star Trek and wasn't involved with it. So within 2 years, I was working with them, and then that went away and sat for 4 years. So it was like the world was blowing up around that time, and I kept saying, fine, fine, give me the new manual. What am I supposed to do? And everybody's like, oh, we don't have a rule book. We're writing it right now. I'm like, well, how am I supposed to pay my bills? And they're like, just hang in there. We'll tell you in a few years. It's like, no, how do you handle this? And Star Trek was in a fallow time, and there was a lot of malaise, right? And I say it was fallow for 12 years. Yeah, we had the Kelvin movies, and thank God, because in the big picture, Star Trek would have suffered even more. And that was a lifeline. A lot of new fans came in. A lot of us were kind of like, well, it took a few years to get it. Oh my God, this is like the life. This is the best gateway drug Star Trek ever had. Because now that you're in Star Trek, now you can go see the real stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It gets your interest, but then you're like, oh, well, how did it happen? Where did it come from? And then you go back and you discover all these fantastic shows that you might like, might not, but at least you do have the time to actually go and discover all these old things.
Well, my biggest thing about the, I mean, I got it, and this is the other ingredient that I didn't even realize. Like, I was a kid in Oklahoma, and I have theater and journalism degrees. I'm not a big media guru, but I started to get it in 05, 06, and then 09, when the first movie came out, was the first time I went to STLV, and there was the secondary room in those days was like the room where the astronauts would give a talk, or where a science person would give a talk, or where, my God,
like
I can
like a stage B. Sort of.
Yeah, I remember at the height of Wesley being like, Will's character, Wesley Crusher, not being like overtly ignored and being mean to, like it was when he was first on by a lot of fans, but just like not, just lost in the scope of being an old, you know, oh, Next Generation's been around and they're the old guys and this isn't the, I remember the first year Will was at Vegas, one of the last times he came, he did a tumbling and gymnastics show, and like 10 people came. I mean, like, let's all put our mats down and I'll lead you in some gymnastics and tumbling you can learn. And he was like desperate to come up with something to do to make to be relevant besides sell, you know, just do autographs. And and it was sad. It was kind of like, this is where all of our, like, and it was like all the people who were lost went in there. There'd be like 10 people for him, or there'd be like 10 people listening to a NASA person or something, you know? And that was the secondary room. Anyway, so in 09, Vegas is 2 months after Star Trek 09 comes out. And somebody asked me to be Anthony on the new Trek movie, which was the hot new thing, website. asked me to be on a panel to talk about the movie. And I said, sure. And I walk in the room and I'm like, oh, there'll be like, you know, 10 or 20 people in the audience. Well, there's 400 people in this room. And crazy. I'm like, whoa, where did these, like, so I get up there and it's all these like bright, fresh face. And this is Star Trek Vegas. Mm-hmm. And there's all these fresh faces, all smiling and looking at me. And I was like, where did you, why, you people do know this is about the movie that just came out, right? Like, you know, it's like, we're not, okay. And we got 5-10 minutes in and we're talking and I said, okay, can I just do something? I have to say, how many of you are at your first Star Trek convention? How many of you have never been to Vegas before? That's what I said mm-hmm. first. And this is the beginning of my famous raise your hand poll that I do at conventions mm-hmm. now. But I said, how many of you are at your first Vegas convention? And it's like 98% of the room of these.
Wow.
And then I went, how many of you are at your first convention ever, anywhere? And it was like the same people. It was like 98% of the room. And I was just like, oh my God. And that's one of those moments, when, like I said in the beginning, it's like, mm-hmm. that's one of those, be alert for the new, because the world we had been in, I had been like struggling to find good things to say about the movie in a constructive way. And I don't mean like it was a horrible movie. What I mean is it was a very well-made movie. Well, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, I remember we saw it, we saw it on a screening on the lot, and a lot of mm-hmm. the old industry people, a lot of the Star Trek community people who were still alive and standing, we were all in there that I'd known for since we'd come to LA. So I'd known for 15 years or something. And a lot of us mm-hmm. were sitting, some had worked on the shows, but whatever. And we watched it. And a couple people got up and left. I remember one very specifically. Like they couldn't take it. And mm-hmm. The lights come up at the end. But the last 5 or 10 minutes, my mind had already said, okay, people are going to ask me what I thought of this. It has to be positive. But what am I going to say and not mm-hmm. be dishonest to myself? And I remember thinking, and I lights come up and I looked at Dave Rossi and I'm like, well, it was a wild ride, you know, which is one of the inane things people say, mm-hmm. right? And it was like, yeah. So for a long time, it was kind of like, okay, like we're all smiling. There were a lot of people that wanted to tear it down immediately, but it's mm-hmm. like, no, you don't do that. And a lot of people don't get that. And this goes back to fandom and trolling. A lot of mm-hmm. people don't get that. This isn't like politics. It's not like if you don't like the person running, you just wait 2 years or 4 years mm-hmm. and you vote for somebody else that you like better. It's like there's consequences, as we're seeing in this now.
Yeah.
If you don't like the other person, you still need to make a decision, right? But people didn't get that that this was entertainment. It's not politics or sports. It's not like, it's like if you don't in some way support this, it's not like in 2 years you'll get another choice. It's like it might be in 20 years you might get another choice. It's like if you don't go support this now in some fashion,
you're going to lose it.
You're going to lose it. Exactly.
Entirely, yeah.
Exactly. So for 2 or 3 years, it was kind of like my two go-to things were, well, it was a hell of a ride. And the strongest thing about it, the thing I love the most is the casting. It was great casting, which was true. I felt that.
Yeah, it's true. It's a good casting, for sure.
So for a couple of years there, it was like, oh, yes, okay. But since that day with that panel room, I was like, oh, my God. And then I went back to my table, and you'd see people walk by. And every once in a while, it was like being a souvenir seller in New York City or L.A. or something. Because you'd see the people walk by, and you can't see me, but people are like gawking, you know, like the tourists from Oklahoma in New York for the first time. I'll make fun of my own state. And, mm-hmm. you know, everybody's like got the slack-jawed, oh my, you know, that, oh, wow, look over here. I mean, when I was a kid, we took a trip in high school during, and I actually remember there were like 3 or 4 small town kids on this, or 3 or 4 small town mm-hmm. schools as students on this bus. And I remember mm-hmm. coming out of the Lincoln Tunnel up into New York, and I swear to God, one of the junior high kids from another town said, look, I think that's a prostitute over there. So I remember people would come by and they had that kind of like awestruck, mm-hmm. you know, Midwestern tourist in New York look on their face. Mm-hmm. I could, after a while, it was like, it was so obvious. And I would kind of say, hey, let me guess, it's your first convention. And they would kind of come over with that, yeah, thing, and there's, and it was adorable. I wasn't making that, but that was the beginning of going, oh my God, we're living through, this is not just a nuisance movie or an annoying movie. Mm-hmm. But my thing was, I didn't see them as nuisances or annoying. To me, they were just treading water. Mm-hmm. I was like, look, you're going to sign a deal for three of these. If it's a hit, that's great. But it's movie actors. You're going to do three or four of them before you don't want it, before you're tired of it. And the last thing you don't want to be is pigeonholed into only being a Star Trek actor because you're a movie actor and you're going to go do other things. And same thing with the writers and director and everybody. They're all, this is not the same paradigm as a TV show where your life is vested in promoting the show because you hope it goes for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years and you want to be as popular as possible, so you're going to go out of your way. This is a paradigm of, hi, I did all the red carpet, I did all the press stuff, you know, I'll do one or two conventions, but I'm not going to be the convention queen or the convention whatever. That's not, because that would be unseemly, and then everyone else in Hollywood would think I can't do anything else, but you know what I'm saying? And I knew that was like people weren't going to, in fandom, weren't going to get that at first. So that was like one of the many layers that just kind of, I was like, oh my God, this is the world we live in now. And I found out that 10 years ago, that was like such a revolutionary concept that that could be a topic, you know, at a convention. My mission turned into, okay, here's some dots we need to connect now, guys. It's it's 2010 now, kids. It's not 1995, and it's sure not 1985 anymore, you know? So that was one of those. But ever since then, I've tried to be aware to that. And now I can easily say all that was true. But you know what? We've got millions and millions and millions of new fans thanks to Kelvin movies. And and same thing with Discovery and Picard. But I started saying, you never forget your first, you know, whether it's your significant other or insignificant other, you know, or it's your first Star Trek. It's like, don't ever make fun of anyone's first.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And that being said, there's something that I wanted to kind of ask, because you've done a fair amount of interviews. So basically, you're the Larry King of Star Trek in many ways. Even though you're did this interviews, and you God knows how many you did, probably over 500 plus based on Wikipedia recently.
They're all up here in these 4 or 5 boxes, cassettes that need to be digitized.
And even though you did all of these as a professional, was there any time when you were starstruck by your guest? And you were like, oh my days, I have to interview this guy or this woman, or like, what am I going to do?
At times, but maybe, because the bulk of those were after we were in LA and working and knowing people, or it was to a goal. Like, I've got an assignment, or I don't have an assignment, but I've got to get this because I'm trying to get people before their memories, before they go on the hiatus and they've drained all their good memory from, which is impossible to do these days, pretty much. Because of the weird overlapping schedules and people are in Toronto and all that. But and the bulk of them were all of that I'm looking at in these boxes on cassette tape. The bulk of those were live, which was much different than just doing a phone interview. And the bulk of them were archival, where let's sit down at the end of the year and talk for an hour and a half and talk about the whole season. So there's a little bit for all of that. But in the yes, to answer your question, yes. And a couple of times, it wasn't so much about being starstruck. It was because they were phone interviews, and it was the first time with people. And maybe they were, I don't want to say difficult, but it was like hard to do, especially on the phone, and you couldn't like eyeball gauge. And a couple of people had quirky personalities, and it didn't necessarily mean that it was a hard interview. It was just hard. It was hard to read the room.
No, exactly.
It was hard to read the reaction. But one of the very first interviews I did was, we were still in Oklahoma, and I was at a convention. It's when it first dawned on me that I could go in as a, and I worked in news, and it was like, wait a minute, I can get a press pass and go interview people. And I will never forget the late great Mark Leonard, you know, who was Sarek and all that. And he was the first. That was the first actor I ever saw. In the old days, they're, you know, conventions paid actors a set fee, and then they say, okay, well, I'll do 2 hours on stage, an hour and an hour on stage, and I'll sign autographs for an hour, and you know, and if they were very gracious. They might, you know, judge the costume contest. And if they were high enough, you would never ask them to do that kind of a thing. But at the very minimum, they showed up 2 hours on stage and they signed autographs for an hour. And they might say, I'll only sign two at a time, Max, or I won't personalize, or, you know, or no, I'll sign until everyone's got it, you know, whatever. And before everything became so, the burden of getting, of funding the actors and the show passed from the promoter's risk to fans, and that's why fans now pay pieces, you know, per autograph, per thing, whatever. Anyway, Mark Leonard was the first actor I'd seen in those baby years of cons that brought his own pictures, because usually you would go, there were dealers that just sold photos, and they'd find out who the guests were, they would stock up and bring those photos, and everybody had to go to those one or two or three dealers to buy your photo, then the actor would sign it. Or you could bring something else, you know. The girls that would have them sign their chest or something. That was kind of crazy. But that's those kinds of things. But he brought his own pictures, and he did it because he was suffering from a kidney issue, which was what eventually killed him. And he had someone else in his family, his daughter or something. I don't want to misquote, but something else. Anyway, it was a new thing. He had his own photos of Sarek, and if you had the option, that you could either go do the normal thing and buy a photo from a dealer and have him sign it, or you could buy his photo, because all the money that you spent on his photo went right to that charity. And that was a new thing. So that was kind of interesting. But so they made me some interview time, and I was like, okay. So I was new, and I had talked to people at home, and occasionally an interview would come to town. But, you know, that was very rare. And I did sit down, and I was being very methodical and kind of fumbling around a little bit. And after I started, I was a little chatty because I was still an Okie. And I was a little chatty at first, and he basically was very brusque and said, yes, let's go on with it. He didn't say, I don't have a lot of time, but that's basically what he said. And I immediately went to like, oh, okay, I'm being too chatty. Let's just get down to the dirt, you know. So I did. But just in the process, I'm just thinking I've got 10 or 15 minutes, so let's cut to the chase. But in that 10 or 15 minutes, somewhere along the way, I said something about having been in theater and had an acting degree and was working in news now. And we talked, and he loosened up, and we got to talking. And after about 15, 20 minutes, I said, I said, really, we should wrap this up. You didn't have a lot of time. And he was like, oh, that's okay. Let's keep going. And that was a huge lesson. I mean, I will never forget that moment. That was a huge lesson about, you know what, if you just engage people, and if you share a little bit about themselves, and if you find a, don't pander, but if you find a common connection, you go from being a perfect stranger, and this is going to be a pain, to, oh, maybe this will be enjoyable. And maybe it will even be like a break and a relaxation point
for
that person. And it's not just about get them to talk about themselves, and that sounds shallow because it's a celebrity. That's what we all do. We all do that. That's what salespeople do. That's what you know, anybody, much less interviewers. It's like a trick of the trade. Anyway, that's one of those moments where I go, oh, so you said ever be stage struck. Maybe a little bit. The one time I really did an interview was Shatner live. It's when they opened the new tour show in 2007 here at Long Beach. And I'd been working on some of the consulting team for content, and also the assembly, and also the PR people. And it was opening night, and they paid him to be the spokesman, and they had an original series bridge. And part of the press conference, and I have the pictures from this, but it was like, now it's all the time and all the museums and all the, but at the time, like he would, the last thing he would do was go sit in an original series like captain chair, much less on a bridge set. And that's what this was. It's like, unless they paid him big bucks, right? So he was the spokesman and did the commercials and all this stuff. So at the end of the press conference was all the press on the bridge, like at the front end on the view screen. I have pictures of this. And then he came out through the turbo lift doors, came out and sat down and said, okay, what do you want to know? And the press literally like did this, you know, suck over. The press looked like the bridge cove, you know, like looked like the ceiling. It all leaned up and over.
Wow.
I was amazing. I immediately like broke from where I was and ran around behind so I could stand behind him to get the, you know, the point of view of everybody leaning. Anyway, it got to the, we were like halfway through this, and there's, you know, 50 people in there, cameras and audio and all that and writing. And we got down to the end, and he was going to do four or five recorded you know, like maybe one person had a camera in 2007, professional. Most were audio interviews. And one of the people on the PR kit came up to me and said, Larry, we totally forgot. We're supposed to interview Bill for the electronic press kit. Like, we're supposed to be one of the four or five interviews at the end with a camera or a microphone. And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, well, we didn't pick. Can you do it? I'm like, okay, sure. And this was before Dr. Trek. This is this is back when I'm just a consultant. You know, here's the image you want, or here's the thing. And I'm like, okay, fine. Yeah. And so I did. I pulled four or five questions out of my ass to talk to him, to say that made sense and weren't the same old, here's my other motto, not the same old thing for the millionth time that wouldn't bore him, right? And we did. And I would kill to have that something. There's like no picture of me doing that. There's no video that I know of. Once again, like my one time I got to meet Gene, there's no camera of it.
Oh.
But anyway, but yeah, that so that's kind of qualifies. But the only time I would be like a little stage frighty is if it was somebody maybe for the first time and I just didn't know how it would go. You know, the only time I really had that stage fright was just the one time I got to be fanboy was, and if you know me, you might know this. After two or three missed times, when I finally got to meet Dee and just get his autograph back before I was professionally interviewing people. That was, I mean, I wasn't a puddle or anything, but I was, part of me was like, I'm going to like be struck by lightning and I'm never going to get his autograph. Something's going to happen again, including the autograph. Something is going to happen and I'm not going to do it. And it finally, and it was like, okay, I can breathe now. I finally have this, but yeah.
I had something similar with Terry Farrell, bless her. She's wonderful. So when I was a kid, I remember, I got the address for Paramount Studios, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna write a letter. And I loved Jadzia Dux's ever since I saw her of DS9, just fantastic. And I had a picture that I acquired from a convention, really small convention, and I was like, okay, I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to put this picture in, and I just sent it out to Paramount, 555 Melrose Avenue. I was like, and I have never got a reply. Because I think I should have included a self-addressed envelope, which I didn't.
Were they still filming? Was it still in production?
No, I think it was. I think it was. No, they didn't film at DS9. I think it was around 2000. No, hang on. I think it was around the end of Voyager, beginning of Enterprise era.
Yes.
when I did. So it was way older than. I don't think anyone had the address for Terry Farrell at that time. But I remember I sent over that picture. I never got a reply. And I happened to meet Terry Farrell in 2016 in London Destination Convention. We did a fantastic photo shoot, like a kind of a Charlie's Angel position. I was just like, do something for me, because I was waiting for this so much. And got the photo, and a year after... I happened to meet her again in Southampton, and I remember I was starstruck, but her, and I walked up to her, showed her a picture, like this were us. Told her the story, and she was like, "Oh my God, this is amazing!" And she was like all over the place. I was all over the place, of course, and that was one of the best experiences I had with that Star Trek actor. But and I had so much, but that's one of the things that it's worth. Worth, you know, waiting for.
When you say you told her the story, did you tell the story of sending the picture in 2000?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Like, well, she had no idea that she was not only was the show out of production and no one on the lot, but that she left with very hurt feelings.
Yeah.
The last thing she's going to do is do it for 5 or 10 years, you know.
I know.
Yeah. You know. But yeah, that's okay. It's okay. See you.
It's okay. I mean, obviously, I didn't tell her that that was the time when DS9 was over the laptop and she was out of the picture. But and I didn't even I spared her that that trouble. But no, it was still fun. Just to, you know, finally get to the point when I was able to actually just thank her for the, you know, for the work that she done, and it was just a really good experience. And talking about acting. There's something that I wanted to ask about, and I'm pretty sure you know what I'm going to ask now. Phase 2 and Star Trek Continues. How did you get involved with these guys, with these shows?
Well, Phase 2 walked in the door. it's very funny. So James Colley. So back in the like the I know over the years, and you can go back and check this, there had been people that had, I did a little like 15 second silent movie in college thing, and then we did parody in college. So people had done fan films along the way-ish in very small ways. But the one that really hit consciousness was not New Voyages slash Phase 2, but, I've gone blank now. It's the Johnson Brothers in Texas. And they built a bridge set, and their science officer was was Bafuzel. I've just gone blank on what it was. It was one of the Constitution class ship names, not Enterprise, not Essex, not Excalibur, not Lexington, not Farragut. It's one of them. Anyway, they became famous, but this was all being done like pre-YouTube, where like people we were all on download modems. I mean, like dial-up modems. And people would, they would put up like an act at a time, not because, well, because they were taking a while to get it finished, but because it would take like 6 hours to download, you know, 10 minutes of video on a dial-up if you didn't lose connection. Yeah. I mean, it was like, okay, act one is going up tonight. Ooh. But it was so new and different. It was like, wow. Mm-hmm. So they had done that. And we were doing Communicator. And I think it was Kevin Dillmore was the reporter that I had. And I said, this is cool. This is so cool. Let's do a story on these guys. And by then, so we had a story. And they sent some photos because we weren't sending photographers on, we didn't have a big budget. So anyway, so they sent their own photos. And I take this back. They didn't have a bridge set. Most of it was shot on location. It was like a planet thing. But they had a couple of scenes on a bridge. And I didn't know this from Adam at the time. And they sent a picture of the two brothers on a bridge set. And they said, here we are on our bridge, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. So that was kind of our caption for the photo. So that's been out for a month. And I'm on a lot day over in the archives or whatever, or at StarTrek.com. And I had to go up to the art department. And so here's Mike and Doug and Jim Vanover and Denise. And I go up to get something. Or somebody has something for me, and Mike comes over and goes, Larry, there's somebody here I want you to meet. I go, oh, okay. And he said, this is James Colley. He's a big costuming fan. He has a lot of build ties. He's a big original series fan. And he is doing a fan film of his own, kind of like the one you just did the story on. Oh, it was the Exeter. Okay. I knew it would come to me. So there's their whole thing. See, nobody wanted to do an Enterprise and be Kirk. That would be like sacrilegious. So they did.
Yeah.
But they all wanted to see the uniforms and the props and the sets, and they were buildable by then. And people were even doing, you know, nation, like, here, do a movie on a laptop kind of thing by then. Effects, right? But nobody was going to try to do Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. That would be too audacious. You know, we'll make too many people mad and ruffle feathers. So we'll do our own original characters. Okay. So that day in the art department, Mike says, Larry, this is James Collins, blah, blah. We've used, like, the hood that we used in A Mirror Darkly for the Defiant / Enterprise's bridge, that we couldn't come up with, you know, like when Mike Sussman said, can we do it? And Manny said, can we have the thing come up? Can we have the Sulu scope come out of Sulu's panel? And they're like, sure, we can do that. And they're like, we don't have budget and time to do that. Well, they knew that James had one on his set. So they wrote and said, can we borrow your mechanized motorized Sulu scope? I always called it the Viewmaster, but you know, and he said the one you see on camera is his, except they paid for it, and then they built a new one on their set in New York because they couldn't borrow things; they had to pay for things. So the thing you see in Inner Mirror Darkly is James Colley's motorized thing coming up, but that's the only way they were able to do it on time and on budget. So they had a connection; they had been, you know, helping out back and forth with things. Fan, as long as it didn't get out, as long as it was kind of hush hush, which is funny later on, but that's a side story. Anyway, he's standing there, and I said, that's awesome, that's so awesome. And I said, and he's like, Larry, can I ask you one? So he's blah 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 blah. Okay, fine. And then he goes, Larry, can I ask you one favor? He says, could you run a correction in the magazine in Communicator? I'm like, what do you mean run a correction? And it was like. He went from this gregarious smiling guy to this not angry, but like pain. He was like, he flips open to that page of the two of them standing on the bridge set, and he goes, that's not their bridge, that's our bridge. And I'm like, wait, what? He goes, they came up and they didn't have their own bridge set, and I built one and they failed on my bridge. And I went, okay. Well, I don't think they were, he says, they were lying. I go, well, I don't think they were lying. I think in the context of it's their productions, I think it's just mm-hmm. a, you know, it was just kind of a generic, here's our bridge. You know, like it's not from anybody else's movie, it's from our movie. And he's like, can you run a correction and say that they were standing on the bridge for mm-hmm. phase for Strange New Worlds or New, whatever it was they were calling themselves then. Phase two was what it was in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I said, and my mind's, because number one, corrections never work. Because mm-hmm. people who are aggrieved, and legally maybe even, if it's crazy enough, but it's more of a political tact thing. Usually mm-hmm. corrections are run to correct the record. And if people, like a newspaper has a, you know, you can look every day, and here's the, and in the old days, I guess. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, online, it's corrected, and they make a note of the corrections log at the bottom, mm-hmm. which is the way it has to be handled now. But I know that most people never, you know, in the real world, the damage, if there's damage, has been done. Like, no one's going to see the correction. So what I, my standard old news line, which was not a come off, it was legitimately honest. I said, James, how about this? Instead of doing a correction, how about we just do a story on you? And he's like,
oh, that would be great. That would be great.
So that day, the reason he was in LA was because their first episode, come what may. Mm-hmm. So there are cameos through there, right? With John Leslie and well, anyway, two or three cameos that are in that. And mm-hmm. he said, you know what? We have a role on our, we are filming one right now, and we have a view screen cameo, and would you do it? And I go, okay, fine. And that's how Cal Strickland was born. Mm-hmm. The other side of that was, I said, and it had been a long time since I'd done any acting, and I said, okay, but just get me the script in plenty of time, right? He's, oh, yeah, it should be a little thing. So I get to, so I don't get anything. And this is, mm-hmm. okay, we have email by 2001. Okay. I was trying to think, where was this? So nothing. So I go over, they're at Doug's house, mm-hmm. using his front living room, different angles. And I get in, and I go, oh, hey, and they're filming, they're filming Eddie, not Eddie Paskey, but John, yeah, Chief, oh, I've gone blank. What's his name? The transporter chief, who was in Star Trek II again.
My mind freeze now. I don't know.
Yeah, I should know. Anyway, somebody out there is screaming at me.
Oh, and me too.
Anyway, they're filming him, and I like, okay, fine. Just give me a script, and I'll go work on my lines. And everybody ignores me. And I'm like, we're filming next. And then I look over and he's got big cue cards. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, it'll be just a cue card. Okay, it must be really short then. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. Finally, they're taking a break. Because this is all community theater. You know, it's like, it's all, mm-hmm. you know, just skin of the pants, you know, flying by the seat of your pants kind of thing. And I finally said, guys, I really want to see a script so I can start working on lines. And they're like, oh, you'll be fine. It'll be a short thing. Well, and I mean, so finally they handed me a script. It's a page and a half of all talking. Well, you've seen, if you've seen it, it's like this long rant he has. And it's like, I haven't, like, we're filming this in half. I have barely worked on this. So I finally, like, went in the bathroom and started working on it and going out. And I did want to go. And at the time, I had no idea that this was going to blow up to be, you know, like the first fan film, and fan films were going to get big. And like, I was thinking, you know, maybe 100 or 200 people would ever see this, you know. I'm glad. But at the time, I was like, and they're just like, oh, don't worry about it. We'll just stop and start. If you mess up a line, we'll just stop and start. And I'm like, no, this is like a connected thought. This is like an arc of thinking that would look for, you know, like we'll cut away. And I'm like, no, I'll look like shit. No. It's like, I was a little pissed that this was a fun thing that I felt like I was put in a bad place on. So the more I thought about it, I mean, I was working, madly working, trying to memorize this and not have it just be memorized words, but, you know, act it, you know, inhabit it, right?
Yeah.
Even though it was a cameo on a view screen. So I'm sitting there, and the whole time the script is sitting in my lap. And it's like, how do I do soap opera acting? You know, like where you cheat and you look down and then you You do one of these.
And you don't even have the teleprompter to actually help you or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So they did cue cards for him. And I came out and I'm like, do I get... So I have cue cards, right? And they were like, oh, we just did that for him because... And I'm like, wait, no cue cards? It's like, wait, what? Yeah, that was part of it. That was part of it. I had these like false... I got teased. I thought I would have... Anyway, so it is what it is. They put it together. You're finally able to download it. I remember going in somebody's office and one of the assistants at Paramount in Trek, one of the Trek offices, and somebody, may have been Juan, the script coordinator, it may have been when but somebody said, so Cal, how's it going? And I'm like, Cal, what? Oh my God, you've seen that, you know? It was like, oh, and it dawned, it was like, oh my God, if he has seen it, then who else has seen it? It's like, and it was like I was embarrassed. It was just like, oh my God, this is like going to spread like, and that was in the slow motion download days, not, you know.
Yeah.
I loved all that, but it was like, so Strange New Worlds, I mean, so continues is when Shatner does his one man show in Hollywood at the Palladium, somebody called me and offered me tickets, and I think I saw my friend Tim Gaskell, who was one of the producers on StarTrek.com, which was long gone, it had been gone 6 years, but anyway, we went, and I knew John Broughton from the Farragut, and he had flown out to LA to see with his wife, had flown out to see the Farragut fan films, and this was 2012, maybe 2011, 2012. And we were up in the balcony, Tim and I, and we came down at the end, and I'm walking across, and I'm like, that guy over there looks like John Broughton, but he lives in Virginia. What's he would have come. I told Tim, I said, that guy over there looks like John Broughton from the Farragut fan films, but he wouldn't have flown to L.A. Shatner's doing this all over the country. Why would he fly to L.A. to see it in L.A.? And as we're like walking through the mob through the lobby to get out the front door, out of the corner of my eye, I see that guy waving at me. And I'm like, oh my God, that's John Broughton. You know? So I went over to say hi, and I'm like, you came to LA to see Shatner's show? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. Larry, I want to introduce you to somebody. This is Vic Mignogna. Oh, okay. He just played Kirk with us in a fair. And I'm like, oh, okay. Hi. So I met Vic there. He just was like, hello, hello. And then Ralph Miller, who is the sound guy, who's amazingly, he's a professional sound guy, but he works independent productions, and he's done a lot of the fan films. And we got together, and he has a very quirky sense of humor. He does a Nixon impersonation. It's on YouTube. You need to see it. 1701 Pennsylvania Avenue, everybody.
Well,
it's hysterical. You find out that Nixon was a Star Trek fan. It's a funny thing. And it's on the tapes, and the Secret Service men have to put up with him playing with his little Enterprise around the Oval Office. It's funny. But anyway, we would have tacos at Ernie's Tacos here in North Hollywood. And one day he said, Larry, there's somebody I want you to meet. I want you to meet Vic. And I went, yeah, I think I said hi to him at, anyway, I had no idea what was going on, but he was basically like auditioning me-ish, but we just met. So we had tacos and talked, and then from there we went over and helped them helped Tim Russ and Walter Koenig get filmed for the Of Gods and Men or was it Renegades? It was Renegades by then.
Renegades,
So they were going to film. So Tim was filming Renegades. Who was directing it? Anyway, they were filming their bits, and they were putting makeup on Tim, and you know they were putting the whole Vulcan ears thing on Tim, and I was like, it was before recorders on phones, and I wasn't ready, but I took some pictures. I didn't interview them. And I walk out there, and here's Vic running the camera for doing some tests. And I'm like, I just had lunch with this guy, and he's a guest, and he's like taking over? What is this? I didn't know it was planned, but anyway. So then three days after Christmas, when I am thrilled to get to work on stellar cartography, because it's the first cool thing since I was a kid in Star Trek, and it's Star Charting. And I'm all excited about, I'm going to clear my calendar and work on this. We've got to get it done like in January, February. I get this call. Hi, Larry. This is Vic Mignogna. Oh, hi. Long story short, he basically wants me to play McCoy. He said, would you like to play McCoy in our... And I'm like, oh, my God. just tell me it's any time but January, February. No, that's right when we're filming. Oh.
No pressure.
I can't. Mm-hmm. I said no at first. And he's like, oh, okay. So he sat on it for you don't tell Vic no. Mm-hmm. So 2 or 3 days later, he calls. He goes, Larry, look, I understand. I cannot screw this up. I cannot screw this up because I'll be cursed by fans forever. And it's the first time in years we've had this cool thing. And if it doesn't sell well, we won't go back. No, no one will do it. Try it again. And he's like, look, we have FedEx in Kingsland. We have internet. Mm-hmm. You know, you could come and then work on when you're not on camera. We have a facility here. And I'm like, because I wanted to. I was really pissed that it was overlapping. So yes. So that's how. So I went. If I look tired in the first episode, it's because I'm like working on stellar cartography at night and doing that by day, and also being totally overwhelmed that the bar, I had no idea the bar was so high. Mm-hmm. It was not typical fan film. All the fan films I'd ever seen were like some version of community theater, and this was like, no, this is off Broadway. This is like, you know, speed, marker, sound, action, go, and professionals are doing stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God.
But I can imagine as well that you have when you played McCoy, like were there a feeling of you that you like, oh, I have to fill up these big shoes, or you're like trying to make your own, or you know, because with that character it comes a certain responsibility as well.
Well, yes, and I'm that's one of the few times in my life that I want to go back and rewind something, mm-hmm. because I was so awestruck, and I felt the responsibility. And Carl Urban had done such an incredible. I think Carl Urban is the best. Maybe I'm biased, but of that good cast in '09, mm-hmm. Carl was the one that really I thought even more than Chris Pine and what's his name? No,
Zachary Quinto.
Zach Quinto playing Spock. Even more than them, I thought, and I think most people agree with this, that he really inhabited, it's like he was totally Dee, but he was totally himself. He wasn't mimicking, he was inhabiting McCoy, he had it down, he had had some affectations, but it was still him. And that was like the model that I wanted to do. I mean, I intellectually knew that anyway, even if I hadn't mm-hmm. seen it. But now here I had somebody else doing it. Because, you know, it was McCoy, it was Dee Kelly, it was my guy. I'd been doing McCoy for years. I had, you know, I had my party impersonation, damn it, you know. Right? I'll certify that right now. Now, Spock, you know I haven't had time to run an examination on him. You know, Spock, do something. That's one of my favorite things. Can you tell? So, it's like, but sorry to make you laugh. But,
no. Sorry. It's awesome.
But I was terrified of looking like an impersonation and looking mm-hmm. like my party McCoy. Mm-hmm. Because I knew it had, and I didn't even know then how great a field the acting quality was going to be around me. And after that dawned on me, I was like, oh my God, so I dialed back, and I dialed back a lot of the, you know, the McCoy, and just tried to be very organic and out of me. Mm-hmm. We didn't have monitors. We had monitors. I didn't know anybody. I knew Lisa and Tim, the makeup people. And I knew Ralph, barely, kind of. And I had met Vic once. I didn't know another soul on the entire set. They came from all over the country. There are people from Seattle. There are people from Florida. There are people from New York. There are people from L.A., the middle of Utah, Ohio. We had crew and cast people from all over the place. And they were anime actors. I didn't know, you know, the anime world. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anybody else to go lean on. I mean, I was in strangers. And I was really, the first day or two, I was feeling miserable because, A, I hadn't had the part long. I hadn't worked on it like I should have. I totally had no clue it would be such a high bar. And I was exhausted from having working on cartography at night. And I really felt down. And if I had just been able to watch a scene or two, or if I had had the confidence to ask, like some of the people were saying, can we watch that back? And I was like so new to everybody. I was like, I don't have the clout in this standing to go say, can I watch that back? You know, I mean, it wasn't like we didn't have the capacity. But if I'd been able to like just have a clip and go, oh my God, yes, I need to fix this, 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 and this. And so I went 2 or 3 days and I gradually settled in. But I mean, and I'm being horrible. And a lot of people afterwards critiqued it as not being a good McCoy. A ton of people loved it, loved it, loved it. and said it was the best McCoy ever, and I hope they weren't just blowing, you know, smoke up my room. But I mean, I and I get it, and you're always the your worst critic should be yourself. Mm-hmm. But the second episode we did, it was a lot less McCoy, but I felt a lot better about where I was and the character and all that. And I'd seen mm-hmm. the first, I knew that and I had a couple of people during the show say, you know, well, where's the McCoy? Ralph would say, where's the McCoy? And I go, I can't go party McCoy. I've got it. And he's like, no, you're not. No, go for it. People were saying, go for it. So it's like I was so worried about what you just said mm-hmm. that I pulled it back a little too far, I think. Mm-hmm. Because McCoy had tons to do in, you know, his first line when he comes down and is yelling at Jim about, you know, we can't just go shooting at everything we see, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
But I love the being on the sets and playing with real props and doing the surgery, and I got to wear the joke was that I always wanted to wear the scrubs because to me that was my place, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The lab jacket, and everybody could have a blue show. You know, Spock wears a blue. What's unique about that? But anyway, it would always be can I wear the? By the second episode, Vic was like, no, regular uniform. It's like, are we gonna get to wear? I need to be in the scrubs at least one. We're in sick bay one scene. I need no. You just came down from the bridge. No. But it was awesome, and an awesome group of people. And I wish I could just rewind, because after that it was like mm-hmm. I wish I could just rewind and go play those days back, knowing what I know now. Mm-hmm. But it's there.
I guess it's a natural course of evolution for everyone. I mean, I'm not an actor myself, never going to be one, but I seen myself doing things when I started my YouTube journey as well. And even this podcast, it's been out for like, I think, 10 weeks or something. And I remember the first time, and then I'm becoming more confident. So I think it's just, you know, practice and, you know, getting back to what you did before, and just trying to correct those things that you think it's not, but actually other people like love that.
The first DVD interviews I did, oh my god, what a snooze. I mean, I was the author of the Next Gen book, so I was on some DVD, and it's like, oh my god, what a wasted. Yes, I was so factual, and so, I mean, like, I wasn't. It's like, it's not, you're in a camera interview for your knowledge or your experience, but you're also there to be like, there's an entertainment element to it too. You have to like come back and talk to the camera, to the audience. You're not just talking to the guy or the girl asking you questions. You're mm-hmm. going to be talking to future generations on the other side of the camera. And I wish I had, you know, I hadn't had an experience doing that early. And mm-hmm. I found an interview we did like in the 90s promoting our local convention still in Oklahoma. And oh my God, there's three of us and a local news guy, and he's like, you know, doing all his shtick. Mm-hmm. It's a 30-minute, you know, local commentary show, which was wonderful for us. But you'd never thought, we thought it was great. We're just sitting there in our chairs answering his questions. And I'm like, oh my God. But yeah, it's that learning curve.
Yeah. Well, you know what? That being said, I'm going to put you on a spotlight now because this is a new segment that I wanted to do, but for the podcast. This is the surprise thing that I told you, teased you about, and the segment called "Do Your Shat," which is a Captain Kirk impression game.
Okay.
So I want you to do your best, Captain Kirk.
Oh well. I wish I had some lines to do, but that would take. So, Gary, we don't know what we're up against here. We've never seen anything like this before. Spock, do something. Spock, analysis, guess, anything? Bones, you mentioned earlier that you've never seen anything like this before. You're not picking, the audio mic is not picking up the hand circling.
That's no, true. I don't think you have to imagine.
Yeah. I don't know. Is that enough? Do we need?
It's fun as hell. Thank you very much for this.
For some reason, I can think of blooper lines better. We had the right, but you had the right.
Now you have to mesh together your this is, you know, for your own thing. You can have to mesh together Party McCoy and your Kirk, and it would be a fantastic audio adventure.
An audio adventure, that would be a good way to describe it. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so there's one, a couple of other things that I really wanted to touch on. First, your Star Trek theme tours, they are legendary. I never been able to sign up for any of them, hence the distance between Los Angeles and Scotland. But obviously you've been doing this for an awful lot of time, visiting many sites. How did you come up with the idea to actually have this Star Trek themed guide tour?
Well, two things. One, a guy named Terrace Cassidy, who has a geek tour. Again, this is one of those things that comes out of, you know, mother of necessity. The 2008 mm-hmm. crash, he had a travel agency in Canada, in mm-hmm. Alberta, small town in Alberta, and he was desperate for how to keep his company going. Mm-hmm. And he's a big geek. He's a big gamer, you know, across the board, Star Wars, Star Trek, Middle Earth, everything, mm-hmm. and a gamer. And he hit upon the idea of doing geek tours, that there would be some people, even in the slowdown, who would still have money and be able to do some leisure travel if it was unique enough, right? Mm-hmm. And so he came up with the idea of going to, you know, the conventions kept going. They were hit hard like everything. But, you know, there was still Gen Con for gamers and Comic-Con happened and all of this. Mm-hmm. And he started doing different themes. And at one point, he was in Las Vegas. He came to Star Trek Las Vegas in 2010 or 2011 and came up to me at one point, and I had my table there, but I was doing my regular stuff. And mm-hmm. he said, "Hi, I'm Terrace Cassidy, and I do this, and here's my story I just told you. Mm-hmm. Do you think a Star Trek tour would work of Star Trek film sites?" And I'm like, "Oh my," because I'd been wanting to do a book because I had all the call sheets, I had the research. Mm-hmm. Here's a shocker: it's not all on Memory Alpha yet.
Oh,
so there's all the there's Vasquez Rocks, obviously.
There's always something to learn.
There's a lot of commonly known places, mm-hmm. The San Francisco landmarks from Star Trek IV. But there's an awful lot of obscure places, and a lot of places that a lot of people wouldn't care about. They're so obscure. But a completist, and I don't know if you know this or not, Gary, but there are people called completists in Star Trek fandom. They want the card signed by the second assistant security guard from the left in that one show. Okay.
Oh boy.
So I said, "Oh sure, yes, I'd love to do this. So we." Mm-hmm. The first one of the big ones, I call it the big tour, we decide to have it lead into Star Trek Las Vegas, which means it's in the hottest time of the year. But we came together, I pulled my factual knowledge, he had his tour knowledge, mm-hmm. and my here's the sites, through a filter of what makes sense to do on different days of the week, what's mm-hmm. gone, what's changed, what's the biggest fan favorite, what's obscure, what's a good mix. Mm-hmm. And we put that together and did it, and we needed at least 12 or 13 people to have it go. It barely made money, and we had about that much. Mm-hmm. And then we promoted for the next year. It didn't make. So we said, let's do 2 years and let the demand, as we promote and our word gets out. Mm-hmm. So then we did one. We had like a couple of people over the minimum in 2014 and changed some things around. And went to the Valley of Fire that year on the other side of Las Vegas, where Kirk dies in Generations, mm-hmm. on Viridian 3. That was Viridian 3. Learned a whole bunch of wacky things about the filming there. Anyway, we kept evolving it and all that. And then 2016 came along. We skipped 2015, but we did 2016. And what I call, I don't know how much you were tuned in, but what I started calling 5-0 fever, because everybody was so into, and there was nothing else going on, remember. It's mm-hmm. So November of 2015, CBS announces this new thing, and we're going to do some kind of a Star Trek show on our new platform. And that got everybody like, oh my God. But there were no details yet. And then finally in March, Brian Fuller's running it. Oh, cool. Okay. And it wasn't until July at Comic-Con they said it's going to be called Discovery, and here's some rough footage. So that's mm-hmm. the timeline. So all that year ahead of time, people were focusing on the 50th, and people who'd never gone to Vegas or they hadn't gone in years, and people from around the world, they're like, if I'm going to go to Vegas for the big convention, it's going to be this year, the 50th. And it was insane. It sold out. The hotel sold out. The four hotels around. I mean, it was crazy. And we had mm-hmm. like 25 people on the tour. So we like doubled in size for the 15th. Mm-hmm. So that was awesome. And we went to San Francisco and did San Francisco things. So in the middle of all that, I'm developing my own company, my own business here finally, and Portal 7, and trying to make that unique and different and something that people can't get anywhere else, and do it online mostly. Mm-hmm. But one of the live things I offered, aside from a meetup live with me, as part of the package of the features, was I gave a discount on a day tour. And I didn't want to compete with Terrace when we did it, even though it was increasingly random when we did. Mm-hmm. Because you can take a tour for anything in LA. You can go to the actor's suicide tour. You can go to the, you know, the celebrity graveyard tour. You can take a tour of, you know, and you can take a film site tour, but it's all generic places, right? From all of Hollywood. Yeah. Nobody was doing it, and there's plenty of Star Trek, you know, including on the lot at Paramount, right? So I put that together just so I could offer it as a discount as part of Portal 47. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, a year goes by, 2 years go by, and finally somebody says, hey, I want to do the tour. I was like, oh, now I have to develop this. So I came up with, you know, because the point was I give you a list of 40, 50 places, mm-hmm. and then you pick what you want, and then I work with you to make sure we can do it. And so it's totally concierge. It's totally a custom trip, and that's what Trekland Treks is. So that came out of Terrace asking me to do the big one, which we're going to do again in 2021, regardless of what's happening in the world or with conventions or what's going on. So we're about to work on that now. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you to tell the world. But anytime anybody's coming to LA, hopefully when this damn pandemic is over, treklandtreks.com and go, you know, put your tour together, and I'll, we go to four places in a day, and there's lunch, and we can do more than one day. So, but that's where they came from.
That's awesome.
That's awesome.
Not to mention this, like, I've always wondered, like, you already been, obviously you've been in many of these places. Have you, how did you feel the first time when you like visited Vasquez Rocks or the Griffith Observatory or even Ben Nice? Like, I remember 2 years ago, I did a road trip, and I was overwhelmed by all of these sites. I think Vasquez Rocks was one of those sites that I was like, I can't believe I'm actually there. And we only had like a day when we were like going through all of these locations. But how did you feel going to these places the first time?
Well, and I mean, you're in the UK. I might as well have been. I grew up in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. So the first time I got to go to the Rockies, the first time I got to go to increasingly amount, the first time I came to Southern California was 87. I went to Vegas to see a friend that I'd worked with. And then she took me down to LA, to Orange County. And we went to the beach and we went to Disneyland. And it was the first time. And you know, it's like, oh. And by that, you know, I was in my 20s by then, but, you know, well into my 20s. So I wasn't like a little kid, but there's times I do feel like a little kid. And ticking off this list, like you said, like Vasquez Rocks, the first time to go, you're just kind of gobsmacked. And you're depending on what it is exactly, you know, whether you're just like, you're stuck still, you're standstill in awe, or you wet your pants, or, you know, whatever your reaction is. You know, you have it. And I don't remember specific, you know, like, oh my God. But yeah, your first time at the Tilghman Water Plant for Starfleet Academy. Those are the two. The thing I get now out of doing the tours, the thing is, it's almost like, it's kind of like all these home shows, the home development shows where they renovate somebody's house, right? Or they find something. And the last thing of the show is they bring the people in and they do it's even the reveal. And they, you know, and the people go, oh my God. And they get it all at once. It's so much that moment. And I've learned now, the last three or four times I've had people walk through the gate at Tilghman and they come through. And I'm like, okay, don't look. And I like turn them around and I get my camera ready. It's for them as much as it is for me. It's like, okay, turn around. And it's just that Christmas morning joy look on people's faces. I mean, I love that. And I try to like get video or get a picture of that moment. So they always, because it's like everything, it's like I said before, you never forget your first. And sometimes it's big and splashy like Vasquez Rocks or Tilghman. And sometimes it's little. It's a little thing. Like you're walking around for a half hour at Vasquez. And then I say, okay, everybody thinks of the Gorn fight. But let's go find Capella 4. And they're like, what? you know, like the 10, like from Friday's Child, and you go over and you've got the clip on your phone or on your pad and you set people up and mm-hmm. you know, it's like, okay, and here's the communicators on Table Rock and here's where the boulders fall on the Klingons and the Capellans. And people, and it's like, and that's a sneaky one because they're expecting to see the Gorn fight, you know, and the tilted rocks. But when you go some, like, and when you line up, one of the best times was when we were at Will Rogers State Park, where they actually filmed the Bird of Prey landing in four on the mm-hmm. on the polo field. So the whole time in Star Trek IV, when Jillian's in her old blue pickup, and at the beginning when they land and they walk, and there's that, it's like green trees and that white simple fence. It's mm-hmm. a horse fence. And when she comes driving up at the end and they do the whole, you love Italian, and they get out and they walk away from the truck and beam away as she drives, that's all at the Will Rogers polo field. And we were on the bus, and the bus has a screen where mm-hmm. we play clips as we go on the big tour. This is on the big tour,
mm-hmm.
on Terrace's tour. So we have the bus, and the thing is playing the clip. And we came around, and I said, okay, guys, now this is going to be very momentary. This is not a big splashy thing. And as we pulled around in the circle in the lot and started to park, I looked up at this little DVD screen and looked out the bus, big bus window, mm-hmm. and it was like perfectly lined up where she's running and going, Admiral, Admiral, at the end. And you could totally see the fence, and the gate in the fence was open.
Mm-hmm.
And she's there, and I was like, oh, stop, stop, stop. And we paused it. And I went, look at this, everybody. It's like, look at the screen. It's like the angle and the screen were exactly the same thing, and you instantly got it. And it's one of those, like, it's like such an obscure thing. You're like,
mm-hmm.
hey, the field where they pulled up, because the Bird of Prey is, like, cloaked, so you don't see it. So that's not part of it. But it's one of those moments where, that moment when you line up a shot with the real thing for people, that was just funny because it was totally coincidence. We did mm-hmm. it. So if we were trying to find it, we would have sat there for 10 minutes finding.
Mm-hmm.
But that moment when people see the real frame from their film, and the real thing over here in life, that's mm-hmm. just, no matter how big or how small it is, that's just awesome. And so I, on mine, it's all, what it turns into is not so much like the easy ones are Vasquez, or the mm-hmm. hard ones are like when you're on the hunt and mm-hmm. you're walking around something for an hour and you finally find the angle, or you finally, you know, you're on the detective hunt. That's when it, that's
you
when
you find the find the cop scene in San Francisco, like, are we looking for nuclear vessels?
Yeah, well,
like
that's
that one shot.
when you're looking for the, yeah, well, then that, when we were scouting, I was scouting San Francisco, and the mm-hmm. the part they were going to shoot with the little boy that was deleted, but the bit where Sulu, Scotty, and McCoy are walking along.
Oh, yellow lines.
Yeah, the yellow pages. It's can't
yellow pages.
The yellow pages, and that little visual joke. Mm-hmm. To find that spot is kind of cool. You're like, oh, look, and then you're like, okay, look. Because the other thing is, these scenes were filmed 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 years ago. And your real life brain is going, wait, things happen in 50 years.
Yeah,
things happen
exactly.
to buildings and plants, you know, in 40 years. But to sit there and then put it back together in your mind is that's part of the fun, too. It's not just walking up and going, oh, there it is. It's like, ooh, cool. And then you realize how much, history has gone by.
Mm-hmm.
We take it for granted. It's preserved for on film, you know. Anyway, that's all part of it. I think I answered your question. Yeah, it turns into a detective hunt as much as mm-hmm. it is. It's going, oh, there's the place. But then you do, yeah, you have a little reverence. And it's weird because then you think, you know, if you were a Star Wars fan and you were in Tunisia, you're looking at sand dunes or something, I guess, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, no matter what your, you know, historians do that when they do battlefield tours, say, you know, or historic building tours. It's kind of the same thing. It's like your thing that you care about and you get to see it in real life. Except battlefields and mansions and things, those were like real, and there's real people there to tell you the real story. Mm-hmm. A Star Trek film site is so obscure to the big world that, like, we're in a little tiny club. We're not in the Civil War reenactors historians club.
Yeah.
That's huge. But the Star Trek club is much smaller.
Yeah, I know. It's like, I still remember when my brothers were asking, it's like, well, what do you like so much about it? It's like, it's just a bunch of rocks. And it's like, no, it's not just a bunch of rocks. It has something special in it, which
I
is...
put up with. Yeah.
No, it was, yeah, it was fun.
Understandable. See, on the big tour, I mean, I'm open to that too. But on the big mm-hmm. tour, Terrace has a thing he calls the alternate mm-hmm. universe package, which is like if your significant other, if your wife, your husband, your brother, whoever's come, your mother, whoever's come with you, is not a fan, they will come up with things to keep them busy. Although, you know, what's funny is most of the Star Trek sites are also real world things. Like I just said, the Tillman water plant's kind of interesting, and there's a Japanese
beautiful, yeah,
house over here. I mean, it's interesting on its own. You know, it's a garden, and there's things about all the plants there. Or the sewage process and why this is such a beautiful sewage plant. I mean, you know, or you're at the Santa Monica Pier, or you're at Will Rogers State Park. You can go up to the ranch house where I give tours about Will Rogers. It's weird how Star Trek and Will Rogers overlap. But yeah, but we have a thing where we cater to the people who aren't Trek fans, but we've never had anybody like that come along or who would admit it anyway. So most of the time, it's easy to find things to keep them happy while you're. But I totally get that. And you said, it's just a bunch of rocks. It's like, yeah, well.
Oh, no, you know, I got this. I got this expression from my brothers all the time, like saying, it's like, oh, look, Star Trek. Like, it's just like, you see a ship flying from there, people shooting to each other. I was like, are you sure that's what you want? It's like, it's not Star Trek. I always had to reason with them. But then at one point I just gave up. And then now we go to the point when actually when they see Star Trek, they send me a picture on my phone saying that, oh, Gary, look, Star Trek on the TV. I thought about you. It's like, really? That's awesome.
And that's so sweet. That's like my,
it
yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
Like even my mom got to the point when she didn't understand why I love so much, and then now she's not obsessed, but she loves going back to Enterprise and rewatch it all the time. So it's awesome.
You're doing your part.
Unintentionally, though, but I guess so. So I know we're way over schedule, at least your schedule, and the podcast.
Oh, no, not that.
No, but. To wrap this up, the one thing that this podcast exists, and I try to kind of find out what people, what is the first thing that come to people mind, and what Star Trek means to them. What is their warm blanket when you think about Star Trek? So, what is your warm blanket when you think about the whole of Star Trek? Which is for you probably would be a difficult thing, having to know you and being literally present for God knows how long. What is your starch? What is your warm blanket,
Sonny,
when you think about
it? Sonny. I appreciate that. I did not see it on opening night, though, just so you know. I was like 8 or 10 years late to the party. I was a rerun baby. My warm blanket about Star Trek. It's when it, I guess it goes, you know, it's like I've been grateful for the last couple of years, and that's why I said I love, I think I said this, I love Life Support Live because I feel like I'm finally doing something aspirational. I mean, the core of Star Trek, you know, the standard line, as everyone says, it's aspirational, it's excitement for the future, it's not dystopian. It means that we not only survive, but we thrive. We don't just tolerate diversity, but we celebrate it, as Gene said with it, right? And it's got the fun, geeky, techie stuff. It depends on rationality with science projected. And it's good stories that are thought-provoking, you know, in the best, you know, a metaphorical way, and issues related. And it's usually got great characters, and it's well cast, and it has really talented people making it as entertainment. I mean, like, all up and down the line. But the doing Life Support Live, I've gotten away from the part that's the heart of Star Trek, I think, the aspirational, because it's like I took that for granted. All these years, I would watch, as I became aware of what I liked, and then when I would start being aware of fandom through the letters like Interstat back in the old days, or seeing what people talk about, it's like, God, so many people are talking about Spock and the characters. Okay, I get it. That's cool. I love them. But this is so much cooler over here. Let's, you know. And now we have labels for all that. Oh, they're shipping. I'm into world building. Okay. And then after a while, it's not just world building, but it's like staying consistent, right? And, you know, the canon, the C word, for better or for worse, and all of that.
Yeah.
You know, and canon is just writing down what we've done so we don't forget it. That's all canon is. Canon is just keeping track of what you've done. Except, no, if you've only been around for 2 or 3 years, no one really cares that much unless you're inventing a universe, and then it's important. But when you've been around for 50-something years, you need to have things kind of tagged, right? It's got to be a museum. It can't just be a room full of stuff crammed in it. You've got to have things tagged and put in order. That's all canon is, you know. And then we decide how we're putting it in order and what different rooms of canon are. Well, anyway, one room is huge. A couple of rooms are side rooms. But it doesn't, you know, they're all labeled a certain way. Mm-hmm. But I go back to, and I came out of my mouth just talking to you today. I think the biggest thing was when I got one of those first two books and my first thought was, oh my God, they planned all this. The this, meaning the thing I already knew I enjoyed, mm-hmm. right? The adventures, the futurism. Like I said, I was a NASA kid before I was a NASA kid and a history kid before I was a Star Trek kid. Mm-hmm. And I really always felt that's what I enjoyed about Star Trek, that it was us, our history, as especially the original series, but always, every time Kirk, like the first wave of self-analysis I did was realizing I didn't sit there and like melt down every time it happened. But one of the things that always stuck with me was when they're explaining something new, like Khan, and they get Khan, all of them, Khan, Noonien, and Singh, and they get mm-hmm. it. And Kirk has some speech like, oh, really? Think of it. Caesar, Hitler, Napoleon, Lee Kuan, you know? And it's like, and they do that thing where not only does it remind you that this is not, and this was in 67, it's way before Star Wars, but you're getting it. This is not a galaxy far, far away a long time ago. This is us in the future. And it's when he says a speech like that, Caesar, Napoleon, Hitler, Lee Kuan, you not only get it, that it's coming right out of the guts of human history, but there's another name he threw in there that you have no idea who that is. Who's Lee Kuan? But you instantly know exactly what he must have been by context. And you go, ooh, that's a gap between even our time and theirs. It's a reminder that something is happening between us and them. That's mm-hmm. just as moldy history to them as Hitler and Caesar and Napoleon are. You know what I'm saying? That whole setup of it being a 3D world in the future. And then, you know, that's why, and I love Journey to Babel because it's like a couple of years combined, you start getting, I remember being in the first grade and we had to write like two lines about, we're learning, and something about rain. Mm-hmm. And it's like just two lines of manuscript writing. So you're going to, like, you're first grader, right? And I still remember what I wrote because years later I saw it. I wrote, rain is wet. Rain is really just water. But I remember, like, when you were a little tiny kid, and it's like, that's a revelation. It's like, wait a minute, rain is just water falling from the sky. It's nothing special. It's just a different, you know, and it's kind of that way. It's like, guys, you do know that this show is about, I mean, this is a wonderful show, but it's only about three guys on this one ship. There's a whole universe out there. Can we please see more of the people out beyond these three guys on this one ship? You know, which sounds like a sacrilege to all the women who wanted to write a Spock story for the 97th main time. Mm-hmm. And power to them, I love them. But that's why it was like, Journey to Babel, can we please, all through the movies, it was like, can we please see the Federation? Can we please see the Council? Can we please see the Andorians and Tellarites again and other races? Can we please? So all of that goes back to that. And when I remember thinking, oh, look, it's all organized. And that, and when the first time I bought three books at a B. Dalton's in the mall after the first couple of books, and when the mm-hmm. David Gerrell's books came out, I remember I bought The World of Star Trek and a couple of lightweight things, and I bought them at the same time, and I'll never forget the clerk there said, oh yeah, we try to keep all these things in stock for all you Trekkies. And that was the first time I went, oh, is that what just happened? Is that what I am? Okay, I guess so. Like, you know, I can remember that as clear as day. But I forget what your exact question was, but I think I've answered it.
I think you answered it perfectly. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, it was amazing. I honestly, I cannot thank you enough to you know, to spare your time and be here in this little silly show that I call Warm Blanket.
No. It's a great, I don't know, is it only about Star Trek?
No, not only about Star Trek. I mean, okay. I try to branch out in the future, so it's gonna be a bit more versatile, let's say. But no, it's not just literally about Star Trek. It's to, you know, to sit down with fans alike, and in a sense, you're a fan as well, because you're not just Dr. Trek, you're a fan. That's how you started, and I'm just really glad that we, you know, we got to explore a little bit of who you are and what you do, and it was just amazing. I'm you know, I could listen to you all day talking about Star Trek, and you know, it's awesome.
Well, here's a southern, I start here as a southernism for you, but then some people take it the other way. I was going to say bless your heart, but I don't mean that in a mocking way, as some in the South. I mean, that's awesome, and I just it's like, it's part of what motivates me is, as the years have gone, there was a time when I thought, you know, all the stuff I saw and I knew and I remember, it's so like, as the new Treks come along, it's so old and dusty, no one cares. Everything's about the new, and I'm about the new too. I'm not trying to live in a cave. And I'm like, you know, it's like a race to keep up with everything new, and not just to keep up with it, because there's a, and it's amazing now that CBS is doing such a great job of documenting things. And we live in a time, a techie world, where people think, you know, but like during the Berman era, shows would go by, and after I got into like being a magazine editor and doing licensed books and things, and being pissed off that you go back to get something that was big, and obviously there must be good photography, you know, before we could just do digital frame grabs and high res, and you were leaning on photography, and especially like high res photography, and you go back even as late as like in Enterprise, and the first time we had an Orion girl. An Orion slave girl, the first, they actually did an all green makeup job on a, you know, and I remember thinking, oh, this is awesome. We'll do posters, we'll do magazine covers with her. And you go back and it's like, you did do a special shoot, a special photo shoot with her, right? No, it's just the regular stage photography. I'm like, what is, what? Thank God some of the people that made special makeup for Mike Westmore took their own pictures. And over the 90s and the aughts, that's what saved some of these images that people see, are the things that other people, not the studio, but the things that other people who got it were, or they were proud of their work, they were smart enough to take good pictures. And that's why we have, you know, and it was before there were cameras on phones. I wish digital cameras had been invented 10 years earlier. We would have had much better, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, all of that was, it was, they're doing such a great job now of documenting everything. And but one of the things I realized was people do love the new, but even in the moment of the new, there are gaps. And if you let it get by and something isn't preserved or recorded out of someone's mouth or preserved as an image, even though they're doing such a great job now, that still happens. And there are still angles, and you can't anticipate 20 and 30 years from now what an angle someone's going to wish somebody had been able to ask then, because the person's, their past, or it's long gone or something, or it's long gone from people's memory. Because that's the thing about Star Trek. After a while, I got to where I try to ask people, like, do you know, how does it feel to know that 30 and 40, like, you know, they could be the second assistant craftsperson keeping the lunch on the table, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, how does it feel to know that 30, 40 years from now, people are going to be, like, studying, well, maybe not their work, but people are going to be studying what they did. And some people... there, sometimes they go, oh, you can't think about that, you just have to do the best you can, and then it's out there. And occasionally you get somebody who, like, they never thought of that, and it's like, oh, and then it's like, oh no, I've changed you. It's deer in the headlights time now. But it's, Star Trek is one of those things. Star Trek is not like 95% of anything that goes in front of it, or 98% of what goes in front of a camera. There's very few. Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who, okay, now, lately, Harry Potter and DC and Marvel movies. I mean, there's very few things, when you think of so much stuff that's filmed from day one, that has a big enough audience. And think, there's cults and niche groups with everything, a lot of things. A lot of things, you know, and some things are so bad. My Mother the Car and Me and the Chimp and Plan 9 from Outer Space. There's something that's so bad they have followers. But... you know, there's very few things that are so hugely big that Star Trek is that kind of thing, that 50 years from now, someone wants to know what the assistant prop person's mother's maiden name was or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's been a thing.
And to get the autograph as well.
Yeah, right.
The completionist.
For the trading card.
Yeah.
So that's a thing that, that's where I've, you know, at the same time keeping up with all the new, realizing that the time when I was thinking, when the internet got going, and now we're having websites, and everybody's incestuously just copying each other's news story, and I'm like, oh my God, you know. And but you do see a story, and you go, that's not new. That happened in 1998, and then you go, wait a minute, Larry, How much of the audience reading that has any clue that that happened in 1998 or this same thing happened already? So it's like, it's the same thing with the wide world. It's the same thing with politics and news and everything else and culture. It's like 99% of this is not new. We've been through this before. So if it's anxiety producing, here's some relief. If it's passion producing, if you're loving it, let me add to your love and your passion even more. And if it totally is something in the 1% that's absolutely ravingly new, this is why it's making such a thunderclap with everyone, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I hadn't thought of it that way. Thank you. I just understand it that, a whole different way. Anyway, that's
I'm happy to help.
That's where I found the life without feeling like, oh, this is just old stuff getting older. And no, we only care about the new. It's like, no, I see young fans come along and they're excited. And it's like, but did you know this? And they're like, oh my God. And if they've been around the block once or twice, because everybody needs their time to absorb everything first. You have to fall in love with your first cast, you know, and your first show. You have to fall in love with that and go through that. But there'll come a time on the third or fourth date, you know, the fourth or fifth date when you're ready to take in more. And so that's what Dr. Trek is for.
And that's what you're going to do in the future. Adding more into this enthusiasm.
Hopefully. And keeping the past alive. Keeping the past alive.
Absolutely.
Pulling those voices out. And that's what Portal 47 is about. Pulling those people out that younger people today, or even middle-aged people today, had no clue about. Or they just never heard, period. You know, you don't see them on a convention. You don't see interviews with them. But they have even more to add to the tapestry that is Star Trek.
Well, again, thank you very much for... No, jokes aside, thank you very much for being here. It was an absolute honor. And for all the listeners, thank you very much for listening to yet another episode of the Born Blanket podcast. And I'll see you in the next episode. Live long and prosper.
And that was it for this episode. I really hope that you enjoyed it, and rest assured, new episodes will be coming out every week where we sit down with a Trekkie to find out what makes us feel good about Star Trek and to discover what is our warm blanket made of. If you really enjoy listening to this podcast, please leave a review on your favorite podcasting app. It would really mean a lot to me. To find out more about this audio adventure, please visit trekkerprize.com/podcast, where you can also listen to the previous episodes. Thank you again for listening to yet another episode of the Warm Blanket Podcast, and I'll see you in the next episode. Live long and prosper.